Going to read from Joshua chapter 1. Joshua installed as leader. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I'm about to give them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon and from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country, to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their ancestors to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. So Joshua ordered the officers of the people, go through the camp and tell the people, get your provisions ready. 3 days from now, you will cross the Jordan here to go in and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you for your own. But to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, remember the command that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you after he said, the Lord your God will give you rest by giving you this land. Your wives and your children and your livestock may stay in the land that Moses gave you east of the Jordan. But all your fighting men ready for battle must cross over ahead of your fellow Israelites. You are to help them until the Lord gives them rest, as he has done for you, and until they too have taken possession of the Lord, of the land the Lord your God is giving them. After that, you may go back and occupy your own land, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you east of the Jordan towards the sunrise. Then they answered Joshua, whatever you have commanded us, we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we fully obeyed Moses, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your word and does not obey it, whatever you may command them, will be put to death. Only be strong and courageous.
Good morning, everybody. So as Peter said, my name is Darren, and I work with the Navigators in Glasgow. And I was actually just saying before I came in there, so I became a Christian at university through the Navigators in your hall up there around 15, 16 years ago. So it's great to be back here. I've been back once or twice since then. A second thing is, I'm from Oban and I'm a therapist. So if I go into a mumbly West Coast accent and you can't hear me or understand me, just say, or you can bump me up as loud as you want, because that is my tendency to start to talk like this, and I'll be quite serious. As you said, so the Navigators in Glasgow, I'll not go into too much of who they are and what we do, but we're an organisation, a missions organisation that's been in the city for over 60 years, and we have a passion about training and making disciples in all contexts of life. So primarily, we're mainly known for working with students, but we also work with artists. We work with people in the first 10 years of work. We have a work in the south side of Glasgow, working with Muslim and Hindu communities. And the idea is that in each of these places, God has placed his community, his family, his people. And what's it mean for ordinary people in every walks of life to embrace who God has said that they are, so that they may be agents of change for the gospel in the places they find themselves. And that is true of anybody who finds themselves known and being known by Jesus. And that's part of what we'll kind of look at this morning in Joshua chapter 1, which I've called The Courage to Walk in Freedom. So I'm just going to pray, and then we'll get into it. Father, I thank you, as we've just been singing there, about the greatness of your love that extends to all people, in all places and in all times. And I pray that as we look at your word this morning, you would empower us and give us courage to know what it means to walk in the reality of the things that you have said about us. Ask that in Jesus' name. Amen. So don't worry, we're not going to go through every single verse of Joshua chapter 1, and we're not going to launch into every minutiae of the Old Testament. But for me, when I was thinking about what we might talk about this morning, this passage is an important one, not just for me, but for the people of God. Because this isn't just the next book in the Old Testament, it's kind of the sequel to the Torah. So you've got the first five books of the Bible, and then now you have the people of God, and they are ready to go and claim their inheritance, go and claim the promised land. It's a little bit, in my mind, like the book of Acts is to the Gospels. You've seen and read and heard of all these promises and truths that Jesus has given, but now the people are told to go live this out, go and be these people in this world. And so the story so far, oh, I need this. I am not good at multitasking, so this may not work even remotely. The story so far is the story of the promised land, that the people of God have been gathered up from the promise that was given to Moses all the way back in Genesis, that God will bless him, that he'd make his descendants as numerous as the stars, and that they would become a blessing to the nations around him. And for Abraham, his family line would eventually become the nation of Israel. And of course, if you know the story, they become enslaved in Egypt. And through Moses, God rescues Israel miraculously. He makes a covenant with them at Mount Sinai, and he leads them through the wilderness. So Israel, at this time, is camped outside the promised land. Moses has previously called them to obey God's commands so they could show all the other nations what God is like. And this book picks up right after, as it says in verse 1, Moses has died and Israel is ready to enter into the promised land, ready to enter into their inheritance. And this chapter deliberately starts by presenting Joshua as the new Moses. He is the new leader and he will now lead the people into the promised land. And so this chapter is preparing them for what this life will look like. The Passover has happened, they've been set free from slavery, but they now need to be ready to live and walk in the reality of the people they've been called to be. They've known life under Egypt's ruling pharaohs, but now they're to cross the river into new life, to build their own civilization. To borrow a phrase from the New Testament, they have to work out their faith and their salvation with fear and trembling. They are to be a new community. So crossing the Jordan into the promised land represents the move into full freedom from the slavery of Egypt to the freedom of the promised land in relationship with God. And this starts by God reminding Joshua and the people of what he has promised them in verses 3-5. I use these little pictures so they try and remind me of what I'm talking about. So the handshake is somebody making a promise, if you're wondering what these little pictures mean. And the promises are the foundations of the freedom that they are going to have. So in verse 3, it says, I will give you every place where you will set your foot. Your territory, in verse 4, will extend from the desert of Lebanon to the great river. So faith, like faith in anything, has to be based on something, doesn't it? And for the Christian faith, as for the people of God, it is based for us primarily on the promises of who God has said he will be and what he says he will do. The promises of God are key and central to what faith means and looks like. And if you study the scriptures at any length, you will find that faith is based on a multitude of the different promises God has made. God has promised many things to me and to you about who he is, about what he will do, about what a good father means to bless and the promises he gives to his children. But promise is obviously a statement you're asked to trust, isn't it? If I make a promise to you, I'm asking you to trust and have confidence in what I'm asking you to listen to. And so a promise is only ever as good as the character and the ability or power of the promise maker. So if you don't have the character or the ability, you need both these things. I don't know if any of you watch The American Office, but like a lot of people during COVID, I slipped into watching old sitcoms. And The Office, that's the boss, Michael Scott, there's an episode where he turns out 10 years previously he'd promised a pile of high school kids that he'd pay for every single one of them to go to college. He'd pay for everything. And the episode catches up to the present, and he obviously has no money. And he has this is painfully funny episode where he has to go to this high school, they're all ready and excited for this promise he made 10 years ago, and he can't fulfill it. And he has to try and work his way around it. And it's kind of funny and painful to watch. But the character Michael Scott, in his delusion, genuinely believed at this point he would be a millionaire. That was his delusion. And so he made these kind of big, grand promises. So he had kind of good intentions, but he did not have the ability or power to follow through on it. This chapter is showing us God is nothing like that. However, for many of us, I guess for a long time, I believe God might have the ability and power, but whether he actually will do anything, does he have the character, does he have the essence of his goodness, well, that's a different question altogether. He might just sit there in his anger and do nothing. He has the ability, but he doesn't have the character. God has both, as we see in Joshua and you'll see through the rest of the scriptures, both power and character. God is not just like a stingy heavenly being who has all the power but holds it back. Yet he's not also like some sort of cosmic life coach who has great intentions towards you but no power to actually follow through on anything, but just says encouraging things to you every now and then. Joshua chapter 1 is showing us that he is fully both character, which is the very thing the enemy attacks in Genesis. Is he really good? He has full goodness and full power, and you're seeing both of these things come to fruition in Joshua chapter 1. And it culminates in verse 5 with this amazing promise where he says, "No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave and I will not forsake you." Even just if you take nothing else away from what I say this morning, what's it like to have God say that to you? "I will not abandon you. I will not leave you. I will not forsake you." Wherever you find yourself, the truth, that's a promise. It was a promise being lived as a reality for these people, but it's a promise for today as well. So trusting the promise giver, the people now need to go and claim what has been promised to them. They need to lean into these promises. That's the same is true of me and you. Like when somebody says, "Trust God," we need to know what we're trusting him for. But for many believers, I don't know if this has been your experience at all, I know it has been for me sometimes, the Christian life can become one of maybe a bit of mediocrity or spiritual dullness. The reality of a personal relationship with an infinite, loving, powerful Jesus seems to have little impact on my daily experience. Prayer can become a bit like a formality. Reading the Bible becomes a bit like going through my news feed. If I see something interesting and new, then it might spark my attention. And the vitality of what it means to be people of God can kind of diminish. Whereas the promises of God are not supposed to be something that hang in the distance to remember. They're supposed to be integrated and claimed and moved into in all of life. There is the Christian life begins by trusting the promises of God. Like in John chapter 5, verse 24, it says, "I tell you the truth, whoever hears," so it's kind of given as a statement, "and believes him who sent me has eternal life and will not be condemned, but has crossed over from life to death." And in trusting this, the Bible is full of more and more promises about what the people of God are and what they are like. They've been given new life. We're given a spirit that lives inside us to be able to help us to live this new life. We are now children of God, co-heirs with Christ, his brothers and sisters, made alive. So Christian life doesn't just start with the promises, it continues with them as well. It's the thing and the source of where we lean into to find new life, new meaning. We need to, like Israel, God has promised this thing, shown it to them, and he says, "Now move in and claim this, and I am with you as you do it." We need to be people who claim promises of God. That's the thing you put your trust and faith in, as opposed to just the ether and the hope that God is kind of there in the distance. But God tells Joshua to do this, to live like this, to be people who follow through, takes, which I'm sure you heard as a repeated phrase, it takes strength and courage. That's a grasshopper, if you're wondering what that little animal is, which will hopefully make sense in a moment. So one of the repeated phrases you see in this chapter is the command, "Be strong and courageous." It's repeated many times throughout the chapter. Now, any time in the scriptures, obviously, when something is commanded, when God commands something, it's because that thing, whatever that thing is God is commanding, is critical to our well-being, is critical to our flourishing, is a key component of what it means to be people who walk in his good design, to be fully human. It's something necessary to our life. But it also usually means it's something we're not particularly good at in our natural resources. It's usually something we struggle with, something that doesn't come naturally to us. And in this context, instead of courage, Israel would be tempted to be guided by and to give in to fear, which is what is made explicit in verse 9. So courage, there's many different definitions of courage, but one of the core definitions of courage that I believe in and I think is biblical is that courage is the living out of your convictions, of what you say you believe. Biblical courage is not something temperamental or something discovered in a personality test. It's more of a virtue. It's like a moral stance. It's got a choice element to it. So it's not whether you're somebody who's risk-averse by nature or not. It's not whether you see a burning building and you think, I'm going to leap in there and save everybody, or I'll stand outside and phone the fire brigade, which is the option I think you should go for. And therefore, the firemen are the courageous ones and I am not. That is an element of courage. Of course it is. But the way the scriptures talk about courage is more of a virtue. It's in contrast to the fear you feel. The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, the book where he has all these short little letters of a demon to a junior demon trying to distract and knock off course the life of a young Christian, has a whole chapter on courage. And it says in this chapter, this is the demon writing to the younger demon, courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point, which means at the highest point of reality. Chastity or honesty or mercy, which yields to danger, which is gives into fear, will be chaste or honest or merciful only on conditions, like when things are right, when things are good. Pilate was merciful until it became risky. So what he's saying there, I think, is that in everyday life, when you go about your day-to-day, when you're at work, you're engaging with people, there'll be these times, these points of highest reality where push comes to shove and your mettle is tested, and whether you can live out of your convictions about what you believe to be true or not. And the point Lewis is making about Pontius Pilate there is that he saw the injustice, he knew the claims against Jesus were false. And for a moment, he lived out of his convictions until he was threatened. They were going to tell Caesar what he was doing. And at that point, as soon as he was threatened and he was afraid of losing power and influence, he capitulated. He gives in to fear, and his fear results in him changing his convictions and handing over Jesus to death. Pilate was diminished as a person because he did not live out of the courage of his convictions. Now, actually, the scene we've got here in Joshua 1 is paralleled earlier in the Bible in Numbers 13 and 14, where Israel had been out of slavery for a few months. And at this point, they're at the edge of the promised land, and in Numbers 13, they send 12 spies into the land to see and check if it is. And the 12 spies come back and are like, it's the promised land, it's full of everything God said. And two of the spies, a very young Joshua and Caleb, are like, let's go in. But the other 10 are petrified, and they say, we seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes. We looked the same to them, because the land was full of giants. This promised land was there, is what God had said, but they saw giants everywhere, and they were petrified. And then this leads the nation into mourning and anger, and at one point they even want to kill Joshua for suggesting they go in. And the result is they wander the desert for 40 years. They were free from slavery in Egypt, but in many respects they were not living in the freedom of the promised land. They wandered the desert. And that's one of the things that fear can do to us, can't it? It makes us feel like we're wandering in some sort of desert. It enslaves us and can cause us and the people of God in this passage to wander around in the wilderness. It robs us of our humanity. It robs us of the promises of God. But to be afraid is not the problem. Like, fear is a basic human instinct. Without fear, we wouldn't have gotten very far as a species. Fear is not the problem. Fear is just the self-awareness that we are not in control of our lives, or that we have some perceived threat that is bigger than us in some form. It's what we do with it is the question. When we give into it, it rules us. That's when it robs us and it robs others of life across the river. As Nelson Mandela famously said, courage is not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he conquers fear. So how does that relate to us? Well, we know, if you are a Christian, that Jesus died for us. We know he ascended and he gave us the Spirit. We all know, if you're anything like me, you're susceptible to every kind of fear, every kind of day. Fear of the future, fear of rejection, fear of failures, fear of age, fear of relationships. It doesn't really matter what it is. Maybe it's the things that come to you in the middle of the night when you're lying awake. And we know that when that kind of fear runs away with us, it's exhausting and takes over our minds and our hearts. But it can also apply to the way you might even think of the Christian faith. You might think of Christianity and think, yeah, we are like grasshoppers, full of the many giants in the land, and can cause a fear with us. I think when Paul writes and he says, I have no shame, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, you have to assume he's saying that because that was an issue. Like, why would you have written that? Maybe he's just boasting. But you'd have to assume that was an issue in the day, that there was something going on that people were afraid and therefore would hide. But fear doesn't just rob us, it robs others. Like, the point of Israel crossing into the new land was not just so they can huddle up and have a lovely little nation and enjoy life forever. They were supposed to be a light to their neighbors. They were supposed to be a blessing to the nations around them. They were supposed to show that when they lived out of the courage of their convictions with God at the center and lived the freedom of how he defined it, it would be a blessing to the people around about them. This is why God commands courage. It's like an instruction. It's not a suggestion. Courage looks at fear and chooses to believe that this isn't going to be like, here's 3 points. But how do you actually do that? Sorry, this isn't going to be like, here's 3 points and then you'll go and never have fear in your life, just so you're ready. But we do get some indicators and pointers from the rest of Joshua as to what this actually means to live like this. This is the rest of verse 7 into verse 9. And in this short little section, we have some of the tools, and by extension, the tools that we have in order to nurture and walk in courage. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left. So there's something about the direction you're looking in life. That you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. So Joshua is told to obey the law. Now, I don't know how you hear that phrase, obey the law, just get your heads down and do what God says. This is a reminder of what we are told over and over again in the Bible, that obedience to the way of God is also tied to freedom. That is how you live life in the promised land. Now, for many people, that is a very counterintuitive statement. How would obeying laws be a way of freedom? That I can live the fullest and freest form of life by submitting to all these laws, by following God's design for life. Well, I guess for me it only makes sense because of how different the Christian message of the Bible is to every other religion and philosophy I know of and can think of. Because in both the New and I think in the Old Testament, it always starts by grace first and then the law. So when God rescues his people from slavery in Egypt and on the way to the promised land, they stop in Sinai and get the law. It's not the other way around. Moses isn't told by God, get into Israel, sorry, get into Egypt, tell my people, here's the Ten Commandments, and once you've got them all sorted, if you're good enough, then I will come and rescue you. Once you've figured this all out, then I'll be present. That's not the way the story goes. No, it is, I love you. I've rescued you. Now, to show my love for you, here is a blueprint for freedom, the law, the blueprint for my new people. And to the degree in which they align their lives with God, they will experience a freedom and peace only God can give. And so will their neighbors. And as they see them having the courage of their convictions. Because freedom is a consequence of a union with God. It's a consequence of the relationship with God. And verse 8 tells us, we have the words of God in our lips. We're to chew on them, meditate on them until they become true in our hearts. I used to think the Bible was something I just needed to master, and I just needed to know every single bit of it. And once I did that, I'd have my head full of good things. No, there's a truth to that. Of course there is. This idea of meditate on it, chew on it, remind one another of it, speak it into your own heart, draw near to what the law is about, a person, a God. Now again, obviously, don't hear what I'm not saying. It's not the idea that if you do this, you never have doubt and fear. We all have doubt. I definitely do. You have to meet it with something. It has to be spoken in a frame of reference against something, with someone who God reveals himself to be in his word. Otherwise, doubt and fear are something we end up surrendering to, and it enslaves us again and again. So while it's not easy, of course it's not easy. If that was easy, then I'm sure you could have made a little course and made a lot of money off it. But the reality is, in some respects, it's also not complicated, because we have a resource far greater than the one Moses and Joshua ever had. They had the Passover, they had the new life from the Passover lamb as God moved in power and liberated them from slavery and the blood of that lamb. Whereas we have the cross and Jesus himself going there, being forsaken for us, taking up death for us. And in moments of fear, think about what the cross means, what the blood means, how it shouts of love and new life that it represents. And the cross is followed by resurrection. Jesus empties himself of glory so that we may have glory in the present as well as the future. The tension of engaging fear with truth and love is part of exercising faith. It is the more we, it's essentially saying there's more going on here than we can simply see and feel in the moment. It's not to diminish what you see and feel in the moment, but to say there is more at the same time. It's choosing to walk and act and live in trust. It's something I think you see Jesus do in Matthew 6. Matthew 6 is Jesus' famous teaching on worry and fear. And he does a kind of a little bit of first century mindfulness with the disciples. He's like, look at the trees and look at the plants. Look how beautiful they are. Now, Jesus isn't just drawing them to nice things to create peace in their mind. But he's using it to challenge them to remember, do you not think your Father loves you far more than these beautiful things that you see in front of you? So fear is something we obviously all regularly experience. But to take out faith is what Jesus is saying to them. He does it in the boat when they're like, do you not care about us? He's like, use your faith. Of course I care about you. I also have the power to deal with this. So we have a fear of rejection. I'll just take you through some from my past week. Fear of rejection. The cross tells us the answer to whether you've been rejected or not, if you're ultimately a rejectable person. And you see Jesus become the rejected one, so we no longer are. To put that on your lips and meditate on it and to tell one another about it. The fear of being alone, John 14 says, Jesus says to us, I'm going to a place to prepare for you forever where you will be surrounded by a community of love and never ever alone. The fear of failure. Like, can I really do this? I regularly have imposter syndrome. No, there's certain things I fail at because I'm not good at it. But the deep-seated feeling of, ultimately, I'm a failure. Well, 1 John 3:1 says to us, see what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are, present tense, that is what we are. If you hear be strong and courageous to mean suppress and deny your fears and put on a brave face, then that will never, ever work. You either become depressed, a fraud, or cold-hearted and angry, or maybe all of these things. I've found myself definitely in those places. But to be strong and courageous is instead to meet the fear and choose to step into something bigger and true. And that takes strength. Of course it takes strength. You take this stuff and pray it into your life, asking the Spirit to make it true and life-changing for you and for others. And I don't know if you're experienced, but it's probably a bit three steps forward, two steps back kind of thing. It's not like I do this and I kind of go in some linear progression. Every time I think I'm stepping forward in one fear, a new one presents itself that is deeper. But the death and resurrection of Jesus are stronger. They're always stronger. That's the promise and the truth of the scriptures. And he will come again. And given Joshua's leadership responsibilities, this charge to be strong and courageous would have been a daunting one. We're again not framed in these promises. They got the promise in verse 5. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong, courageous, be strong, courageous. Then verse 9. And the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. He's not just saying, Joshua, just go be strong and courageous and figure out and work really hard. I'm with you. I will not abandon you. I have never abandoned you. And I will constantly be. These commands are always surrounded by the promises of God. In fact, I think most commands, I don't know, you can challenge me on this after, but most commands you find in the scriptures are tied to a promise about either who God is and or what he will do. They're never just do these things for randomness sake. They're tied to the character of God. So fortified by these assurances, finally and briefly, he's told to go forward in the constant presence of God. He's empowered to receive his commission, his purpose, and calling for courage. But it's obviously not just for him, is it? The charge to be courageous, to enter the promised land, is obviously not just a sole command for just Joshua, but for the whole community. All of Israel is involved. Even the tribes who kind of already had their land, they were like, no, we do this together. We commit to this together. Joshua reminds the people that God is going to do what he said he's going to do. And he's already starting to do it here and there. And take them into a place of rest. It's another recurring word you hear in the second half of Joshua. And a bit like the Old Testament word shalom for peace, of the Eden-like harmony and unity that is. Rest suggests freedom from threat, the enjoyment of an inheritance, security within the borders of the land, and a state of all-round well-being. They now need to trust the promises of the promise giver, not to be taken over by fear, but instead through a courage that addresses their fears with who God is, what he is like, meditating on them and speaking them, but actually putting them into action. A lot of Joshua 1, it's like, let's get ready. Let's get ready together and go and move into becoming these people together. They're to walk in and claim the promised land. And in Hebrews chapter 4, the author of Hebrews ties some of these rest themes together, and he encourages the New Testament church to strive to enter the rest. And rest and striving often don't really go together. Rest usually means for me doing literally no striving whatsoever. But there's like, strive and work to this thing that you have already been given. Walk in the reality of the people you already are. And together in verse 16, they commit to doing all of what has been commanded. Which is a beautiful picture of Christian community. It's supposed to people who come to a place because they have nothing better to do on a Sunday morning. It's a group of people who are being formed together, committing together, walking together based on the promises of who God is and what he said is true. Because fear, by contrast, usually leads to isolation. We fear sharing our reality. We fear sharing our fears. When we feel fear, if you're anything like me, I try to just numb it down with bits of comfort. Fear usually makes us hide. But biblically, we're never alone, and that can work both ways. You're never alone in the sense there is an enemy who wants to encourage that fear and isolation. But also what we've been reading in Joshua is you're never alone in the way that God will never abandon you. And that fear brought into the light, brought into community, brought alongside the character of God, brought alongside his promises, that's the exercising of faith. That's not a negative. I know for a long time I thought it was a negative. If I feared or doubted something, I should hide it to present myself as a better person. But the bringing it out into the light against the promises of God in community, that is the exercising of faith. And the book of Joshua is ultimately about how God keeps his promises and covenant renewal to follow and live in these promises. And just as an ending point, if you shoot hundreds of years into the future, back on the banks of the River Jordan, you see John the Baptist handing over to Jesus. And Jesus calls a new group of people to follow him, to trust him, and the promises he says. And then the risen Jesus, when he gives the Great Commission, for me there's parallels here of when he gathers the people, and it says in Matthew 28, when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Which has always encouraged me, that little addition in Matthew 28. I always think if the resurrected Jesus appeared, I'd be fine, I'd have no problems. They're standing there with the resurrected Jesus, and they've got some questions and doubts and fears. And to that, Jesus says, and comes to them, all authority in heaven and earth is mine. It's been given to me. Therefore, you go and make disciples of all nations. It's that promise again of, you now go. And at the end in verse 20, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. The command for us to go and be the new people of God, to make disciples of all nations, is sandwiched again between the two great promises where Jesus says to me and you, I have all authority here. All resources are mine. I've got all the resources. And I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And to be people who claim the promises of God is not just to make up things in our mind, but to lean in to who God is and what he has already promised as the promise giver. I'm going to pray, and then I went over the time Tim told me to. So if you have any complaints about that, you can complain to Tim, not me. Father, I pray that whatever fear looks like in our life, if it's a very tangible present thing or it's a more vague thing at the back of our minds, I pray that your Spirit would highlight to each one of us the promises of who you are, your power, your resources, your character, your goodness, and to have strength and courage, not to ignore our fears and pretend they're not there, but to lean in to the bigger and truer, more beautiful, wonderful things of who you say you are and who you say we are as a result. We pray for the people in our lives, Lord, for this is a big issue. And we know in our culture that fear and anxiety cripples many, many people. And I pray we would not leave here just thinking it's a case of just take a few Bible verses and you'll be okay. But that we lean into the reality of who you are as a resurrected God. I ask all that in Jesus' name. Amen.